This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Current polling suggests that this year's presidential election could come down to two septuagenarians in Republican President Donald J. Trump and independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He currently leads that race for the Democratic nomination. But for people who were born in the early 1980s through the late 1990s, they're seeing their power increase in some sections of national politics. Their rise and their stories are part of a new book by Time Magazine national correspondent Charlotte Alter. It's called The Ones We've Been Waiting For: How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. Alter joined us in this pre-recorded interview. Charlotte Alter is a national correspondent for Time Magazine and is our guest on the telephone today. Charlotte, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. And the name of the book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For: How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And I'm wondering if the fact that at the time of this conversation, it looks as though we could have the two major parties nominate for president, Donald Trump, a Republican who will be 74 on Election Day in November, and the Democrats could nominate Bernie Sanders, who will be 79 on Election Day. It seems somewhat to contradict the idea that there's a new generation of leaders. On the other hand, polling suggests it is younger millennials and people who are even younger than that driving the rise of Bernie Sanders. I'm curious, before we dive into your book, your thoughts on that dynamic.
So, yeah, I mean, you hit the nail right on the head. We do have two men in their 70s who are very likely to be facing off against each other in November. I do think that this is still a generational election, though, because Bernie Sanders is somebody who is only the Democratic frontrunner because of his rock-solid support with young voters. And what my book traces is the forces that have shaped millennial politics, and it explains many of the reasons why so many young people feel that Bernie Sanders is the candidate who best represents their interests. So, you know, in some ways, Sanders is maybe like the exception that proves the rule, because he is an old man, just like many of these other men in their late 70s who are running for president. But he's an old man with new ideas, or new sounding ideas. And that's why he's the front runner right now.
Exactly. He's not the only man well into his 70s who's seeking the Democratic nomination. You have Michael Bloomberg, who's in his 70s. You have former Vice President Joe Biden, who's also in his 70s. What do you think it is about Bernie Sanders, beyond just the new ideas, that the other two candidates I just mentioned aren't quite able to resonate with young people the way he does?
Oh, I mean, not that they don't quite resonate with young people. They have almost zero resonance with young people. I mean, the reason that Bernie Sanders is able to resonate the way he does is that he is speaking specifically to issues that young people care a lot about. You know, he's talking about student debt. This generation has four times as much student debt as their parents did. He's talking about income inequality. This generation has 34% less wealth than their parents did at their age. He's talking about climate change and the Green New Deal. This is the generation that is really going to have to be dealing with the impact of climate change. So he, you know, it's not just that he's been talking about these issues. In some ways, his age helps him with this cohort, because he can prove that not only is he talking about what they're wanting to hear, he's been talking about it for decades, and he's been consistent in his support for many of these policies for years and years, even when they were really unpopular. And that, to many young people, is evidence that he is kind of not going to sell them out in ways that they might be worried that a less committed politician might.
One of the major issues on the campaign trail is healthcare reform. And, you know, when you think about older Americans, they're the ones who are more likely to need more regular visits to the doctor and possibly even more expensive procedures. Why is it the millennial generation that's so much more vocal about a need for change on that policy area?
Well, you know, I think that you nailed it already in your question. I mean, you're right that older Americans do have more healthcare needs, but they also have single-payer health insurance. And so in some ways, and not only that, they have, they have Social Security, which is essentially a universal basic income. So I think what many younger people are saying is they're saying, listen, we know that the government has the capacity to provide high-quality health care to people because we see that the government can do this for our elderly people. We see that they do it for people living under the poverty line. We know that this is possible. We just want it to be possible for everybody because too many people are left out of that when you draw the boundaries for who gets health insurance the way we've drawn them. And I think that that's their basic argument.
And it does seem that Medicare or Social Security can be somewhat described as socialist programs, and socialism is sort of a dirty word in politics. And you write in your book, in your section about Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president, a statement that he made a year ago on the MSNBC show Morning Joe as it relates to socialism. You put this into context about Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he was pushing for his New Deal policies, and some actual socialists in the country didn't think Roosevelt went far enough. And you see, according to your writing, a somewhat similar dynamic playing out here in 2020. You wrote that part of Roosevelt's genius was realizing that ideology was irrelevant for most American voters, meaning that he could ditch the term socialism and just focus on the outcomes. And Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, said something similar to that about the way that his generation, the millennial generation, approaches policy. He says, quote, "But if you're from my generation, the real interest is it a good idea or not? We don't care whether it reads to some conservatives as more socialist or not. We care about whether it works." Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I think that that's a really important point, and it gets at two crucial points about socialism. One is that, again, so I'm looking at millennials who were born between 1981 and 1996. So these are people who were, the oldest were 8 when the Berlin Wall fell, okay? So they don't have, they don't remember the Cold War. They weren't raised with the specter of the Soviet Union hanging over them and fear of creeping socialism. So there's just not that sting attached to the word. In fact, when many millennials think of socialism, they think of economies in Northern Europe where there's free childcare and free education and government-sponsored healthcare, and or someplace like Canada where the healthcare system is much more heavily funded by the government, or the UK or France. And so I think that they have a different set of they have a different context for the word. It doesn't seem like a looming threat to American freedom. In fact, for many of them, it's unchecked capitalism, the greed of corporate interests, the greed of bankers that caused the financial crisis that's had the worst impact on their own lives. But I also think this gets to another point about how these words have been used in our politics over the last couple of years, because millennials grew up in an era where Republicans were still attacking nearly any program that any Democrat tried to implement as socialist. So they saw Republicans attacking the ACA as socialist, expanding any kind of education funding, socialism. And, it's almost like Republicans became the boys who cried wolf over socialism because they kept saying that all these things were socialist, and many millennials were kind of like, oh, well, that doesn't sound so bad. So in some ways, by using socialism as an attack for so long, Republicans may have inadvertently neutered it. And if you're saying that a slightly higher tax rate to pay for some climate change proposals, that if that's socialism, then maybe socialism isn't so bad.
I want to talk a little bit more about Pete Buttigieg, the former South Bend, Indiana mayor, because he is a millennial and he is profiled in your book. You have some really nice sections about him. But I thought there was an interesting moment in a recent Democratic debate on television in which it was noted that basically his own generation is coming out more strongly for Sanders than for him. And I'm wondering if during the course of shaping your profile of him and others, were you able to identify why that may be.
Well, I think there's a couple things at play here. One is that Bernie Sanders is simply more politically aligned with where this generation is than Pete Buttigieg is. He is, and my book traces all the reasons why millennials have moved to the left, and that it can help explain why so many young people are with him. But I also think that age reads differently to different voters. And what I mean by that is that when I've talked to voters in their 50s or 60s, often people who support Pete Buttigieg, they say that they like him because he's young. And when I ask them about some of the other candidates, these are people who are themselves middle-aged or even older. They think that, 78 is too old. And when I get into it with them and I ask them, why they think that, it often comes out that, they feel like they're in their 60s, they might be approaching retirement, they might be slowing down, they might be, finding that some things are a little bit more difficult for them. And they think, oh my gosh, how could somebody who's 15 years older than me take on this, the most difficult job on the planet? And I think that the effects of age, what age means to your mental and physical capabilities, are only evident once you reach a certain age. And I think young people are much more willing to just kind of write it off as, oh, who cares? He gave a good speech. He could be president. And they don't understand, or they're not as the actual impact of age on, how much somebody is capable of doing and taking in new information and executing in a single day, are not as visible to them because they have not aged themselves. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Our guest today is Charlotte Alter. She's a national correspondent for Time Magazine. Her new book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And one of those members of the new generation of leaders that you profile in your book is Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, affectionately, or maybe not so affectionately, often referred to as AOC, a Democrat from New York. She unseated an incumbent member of Democratic leadership in a primary, and you document her early campaigning and her social media video use in announcing her run, which began with her looking into the camera and saying, "I have a super crazy announcement." And I'm wondering, and I hope this isn't a stupid question, but is she the millennial's millennial?
I definitely think that she is in many ways the most millennial of all of these millennial candidates and millennial electeds that I have been profiling. Just because she, she aligns with the rest of her, with many other people her age in her support for Bernie Sanders. She is more fluent on social media than many of her fellow millennials. And again, almost all millennials use social media, but it's not necessarily a given that every single one of them is excellent at it. It's a medium just like any other. And I think that social media is to AOC what the radio was to FDR or what television was to JFK. It is just a medium that absolutely has revolutionized her ability to connect with her constituents and her voters and her supporters. And I think but as a reporter, the use of social media has been very interesting and has been actually pretty lucky because Facebook in roughly 2015 to 2017, Facebook was really urging people and had changed their algorithm to really encourage people to use Facebook Lives. And those were live videos that people took of their experiences, hanging out with their friends, whatever they were doing. They would take these live videos and then they would save to Facebook. Whereas today, a lot of people use Instagram stories or Instagram Live or Snapchat, and those things disappear after 24 hours. So I was able to find live video footage of many of the events that these subjects experienced, from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's trip to Standing Rock, to her trip to the Women's March, to the beginning of her campaign for Congress, and some of my other subjects. One of the other figures in this book is Braxton Winston, who is a city council member in Charlotte, North Carolina, who protested against the killing of Keith Lamont Scott. He was a Black Lives Matter activist. And he live-streamed his time in the streets with Black Lives Matter. So having that raw video footage of events that you're covering as a journalist several years later is incredibly valuable. And it's something that we only have because this generation used social media the way it did.
You talk about Ocasio-Cortez's social media use and those videos and how you uncovered them. And I saw you tweet recently about the New York Post's coverage of them. And they are sort of presenting them in a way to, it seems like they want to embarrass her. And I suppose one of the videos that I saw that they shared was in the context that she's eating a sausage biscuit or something along those lines. I know it had meat in it because she had in one of those videos encouraged young people to maybe eliminate meat at least one meal a week as a effort to fight climate change. I'm wondering, based on your study of her for this book, what can you tell us about particularly conservative media outlets' fascination with her?
They are obsessed with her. And listen, I've watched all of these videos. And by the way, you know, it is interesting that the New York Post only uncovers these videos just a couple of days after I, you know, revealed them exclusively in Time and right after my book comes out, which is all about them. But, you know, that's a different story. but it is interesting because, listen, there is an obsession with trying to find some kind of hypocrisy about her, right? You know, she wants to, you know, she's for reducing income inequality, yet she wore a nice dress, you know? And there's this idea that anything she does in her life that ordinary people do, like eat a hamburger or wear a fancy dress on The View or have a nice business suit to go to work in, that somehow invalidates her message of trying to create a more equal society, that like if she spent, you know, if she's not wearing a garbage bag, then she's somehow a hypocrite, which is something that's a particularly difficult position and a set of expectations that's very specifically applied to women and to women of color specifically, because I can guarantee you that if AOC showed up wearing a burlap sack or a t-shirt, or, you know, then the criticism would be, why does she look so bad? So it's kind of like, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But I do think that the thing about AOC is that, you know, I don't think that she's a vegan. You know, she never said nobody should ever eat meat again. She said, you know, maybe try to cut back a little bit. And then, you know, they found her eating a sausage McMuffin, or I forget exactly what it was. But there's always this kind of tendency to make her seem as if what she's advocating for is like incredibly extreme and universal and locked down, like abolish meat. And actually what she's actually advocating for is often much more reasonable than that. And so she's often put in this position where it's like she can't both fight for justice and live an ordinary life or have any fun. You know, for example, a couple months ago, you know, they dug up these videos of her dancing with her friends at college, you know.
Yeah, it was like the Breakfast Club reenactment.
Right. Like, you know, as if that was somehow a problem, that, you know, she must not care about poor people because here she is smiling and dancing in a video. And I think most people can see that there's something deeply sort of sexist about that, like that ridiculous standard is something that wouldn't necessarily be applied to a man who had different politics than her.
Well, I know that we're short on time, but I want to make sure that we note that you do talk about some millennial leaders who are on the other side of the political spectrum, one of whom is New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. She came to national prominence last fall during the impeachment hearings in the U.S. House when she sort of took aim at at Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, suggesting that he's making up rules as he goes along. She's had a sort of complicated relationship with the presidency of Donald Trump, basically calling him out when Trump told people like AOC and the rest of what is known as the squad to, quote, go back where they came from. But then she refused to vote on a condemnation of the president's remarks, which you note in your book. You also note that she represents a moderate district in a blue state. How do you see her effectiveness in balancing all that?
So I have to note that, unfortunately, I had to stop writing my book at late last year in late October, early November. So her turn in the impeachment hearings is not in my book because I just had to let go of it and send it to the printer. But what, you know, what Elise Stefanik sort of represents is this, you know, she was really trying to tiptoe along this path of sort of distancing herself from the president, but not totally condemning him, but also not totally embracing him, just kind of like finding her own way forward that wouldn't, where he wouldn't rub off too much on her, but also she wouldn't get his, get attacked by him. And I think what we saw with her turn in the impeachment hearings is that that path became increasingly narrow and difficult to navigate and then began to disappear altogether. So for Republicans, particularly young Republicans, there came a point in the Trump administration when you had to be either with him or against him. And the people who had been trying to kind of, you know, carve out their own way where they could be neither or both became impossible. And Elise Stefanik clearly has decided that she is with the president, and now she has very much embraced him in a way that she definitely wasn't doing earlier in his presidency.
Well, she's a millennial on the president's side. I want to ask you before we say goodbye, if I can, the last two presidents, Democrat Barack Obama, Republican Donald Trump, how do they fit in the millennials' view of politics today? How have they influenced them? What's their lasting legacy for this large population?
So one thing that I found in this research is that I think, like I said earlier, people form their politics based on the events of early adulthood. And one thing that's really important to know about that is that popular presidents tend to attract young people to their party and unpopular presidents tend to repel young people from their party, and that sticks. So what we've seen over not just the last two presidents, but actually the last three presidents, if you go back to George W. Bush, is a very unpopular Republican president in George W. Bush. He started two unpopular wars. A president, Barack Obama, who was not only fairly popular throughout his presidency, but also was extremely popular with young people in particular. And they elected him. You know, they won him Iowa, they won him the nomination, and then they won him the presidency. And then you have Trump, who's been fairly underwater for most of his presidency, especially with young people who tend to disapprove of him. The last number I read was 70% of young people disapprove of him. And not only that, nearly half of young Republicans defected from the Republican Party over the course of Trump's rise. And then some of those, like, you know, about a quarter went back, but about a quarter of young Republicans defected permanently and are now call themselves independents and are no longer affiliated with Trump's GOP. So I think when you take that all together, what you're seeing is an explanation for why the Republican Party is in so much trouble with young people and why the Democratic Party, you know, does have this surge of youth momentum, but it's a little complicated because it's not going in exactly the direction that, you know, some of the more moderate establishment figures in the party predicted it would go. Instead, it's going towards Bernie Sanders and towards dragging the party to the left.
The name of the book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. The author is Charlotte Alter, a national correspondent for Time Magazine, and our guest today. Charlotte, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.